Hello and welcome to another episode of Monday Mile, your walk and talk podcast, your source of moving motivation. Today I am graced by the presence of Great Britain's most successful Paralympic athlete of all time, as of Tokyo 2020, and securing her 17th Paralympic gold medal. Today we have a very special episode to mark the announcement, as our guest is an official nominee for BBC's Sports Personality of the Year. It is Dame Sarah Story. Wow. Welcome.
Oh, wow, welcome. Thank you. No one's actually said that to me in that way yet, so that's like, whoa, it's getting real.
It is really real. It is the end of this week. You find out.
It is. It's in Manchester. It's the last red carpet of the year, biggest sports night out of the year. So a lot of the people that will be going I won't have seen since the Games, which is going to be really lovely to see again. And yeah, we get to review the whole year of sport, which is always amazing, a massive roller coaster of emotions as you remember all the different things that you've watched and enjoyed.
And what a year it's been. A year with very little sport and the success of both the Olympics and Paralympics. To have that rounded up, are we going to see you relax or is it still full bore?
Oh, well, I'm back in training now, but I have been having I did have a good 3 months where I was just messing around on my bike rather than actually doing any training. But I've been back in training about a week now, maybe a bit more. No, 2 weeks. Nice. I can't even count. Maybe I'm still not back in training. But no, I've just really enjoyed the time after Tokyo. Just to kind of take stock, really. Back in training about a week now, maybe a bit more. No, 2 weeks. Just to kind of take stock, really, because without anybody there and kind of that immediate feedback you get from loved ones when you cross the finish line, the Christmas, so it's almost here.
The wheels are still on, just about. So we're not in your homeland. We're in London. You've spent a fair bit of time here. Where exactly are we today?
Well, we're walking through the Olympic Village, which is really exciting. And I do come down here fairly frequently, and it always gives me the same feeling of like, oh, this was our home for 3 weeks during the Games of 2012. So we're walking through a park area, and if I'm not mistaken, to the right and left of here was where the food hall was.
No way.
And the Transport Mall. Now, the Transport Mall and the food hall is now what's called, oh, now it's got a new name because there's a load of houses there. And if we were to go left here and towards the end, towards the main body of the park, then we'd get to where the GB block was. So yeah, it's all, and this bit had little coffee carts and lots of seating areas. And of course it was a really sociable time because unlike Tokyo, we weren't in lockdown. We could kind of go and hang out with whoever we wanted. And it was amazing. I remember riding the tandem with Helen Scott on the back.
No way.
Along that little boulevard bit here. First time I'd ever piloted the tandem and she was squealing and we were just riding our way to the food hall.
That sounds absolutely brilliant. You almost can't imagine that there was an Olympics here in these blocks. They definitely look a lot nicer than the blocks that I stayed in Sochi and Pyeongchang.
Yeah, these were built with the idea of, you know, being sold on almost before they were built, I think. And you know, the redevelopment area of this part of London was just a huge project for not just the Games, but for beyond the Games. And I guess the legacy of the Games really is this kind of marvellous low traffic neighbourhood, because there's so many bike paths and then this beautiful park. And yeah, you get to still come back here to race at the Velodrome, and it brings back all those memories.
So take us back to the start of your Olympic career. You're most famously known for dominating on two wheels, but you actually started out in the swimming pool.
So my first Games was in 1992, which is probably
1992.
You probably weren't even born.
I was one.
You were one, my goodness me.
So there's how is that even possible? You look the same age as me.
So yeah, I just finished year 9 at high school, and as swimmers can often be, I was young, but I wasn't the youngest in the team. So it was three of us who were 14. It was a couple of 15-year-olds and a 16-year-old. And I came home from those games with two golds, three silver medals and a bronze, two world records. And I just thought, I want to do this for as long as I can. This is just amazing. And the Olympic Village in Barcelona was right next to the port. There's an amazingly huge hotel there, just on the edge of the village now. And I've stayed there. And you can see from the hotel the village where we stayed. And then you can also see the hill where all most of the venues were. And it was a little bit of a mecca going back there for me, and kind of showing Barney where it all started for me when I was a teenager. And he's like, what was I doing at that point? And of course he was, you know, like, I mean, that's at high school and thinking about GCSEs.
So your first games, age 14, you rock up, delivered, took two golds at such a young age. That must be unheard of.
It was just one of those, I just wanted to do it. That's all I'd wanted to do since I was six. I'd watched the games in 1984, and I just wanted to be an athlete and compete for my country and know what it felt like to stand on the podium. So I'd calculated that the earliest I could possibly do that was in 1992. So when I got the opportunity to go to those games, it was, yeah, just that, yeah, dream come true teenager. And I just wanted to do it for as long as I could. And I kind of said this a lot since the games in Tokyo. I've really maxed out that dream because I am still doing it 30 years later.
So off the top of your head, can you actually memorise your medal count?
So 17 gold, 8 silver and 3 bronze from the Paralympic Games, and 40 world titles for a total of 60 medals at the World Championships.
And that is why you are the greatest Paralympian to have ever lived. That's absurd. What was it that prompted the change from swimming to cycling?
Well, initially I was using cycling as a cross-training tool, and it was just because I wasn't allowed in the water. I had some ear infections that were just pretty persistent. So to be able to get on a bike and just train my heart and lungs, it obviously wasn't that great for the feel of the water, but it was brilliant for my heart and lungs. So I ended up just training more and more on a bike as these ear infections were just particularly persistent. And by the time my ears were better, which was about 6 months later, I'd been racing a bike as well, because I'm sort of a fairly competitive person.
Oh, really?
And British Cycling had spotted me at the velodrome, learning to ride the velodrome like any public person can do, go to a taster session. And they were particularly interested in why I was doing more and more cycling. So I said, well, I'm just training for when I can get back in the pool. So they offered me a trial over 3,000 metres, and I was a second outside the world record at that point. So they said, well, if we're going to select you for the European Championship, and that's in 3 weeks' time. And I went to those Europeans, having watched the Tour de France for 3 weeks, and tried to kind of learn as much as I could about cycling, and I broke the world record. So it gave me this kind of...
You say that so casually. I had an ear infection, I did a bit of cycling, and then I broke the world record. That is just absurd. You must have some sort of inner... inhumane drive. Where does that come from?
Well, it's sort of, it would take too long to explain the ins and outs of how I basically pestered Barney, because Barney, my husband now, he's a cyclist, and I met him in the games in Athens. Yeah. So when I started going down to the velodrome to learn to ride the track, he's like, hang on a minute, I know that girl, quite like that girl. So he used to come and see me a lot, and then we started going out, he moved in, and so I had this expert who was my boyfriend at the time. And I used to just ask him lots of questions, and we used to just talk non-stop about cycling. So it sounds very sort of casual, oh yeah, I did this, I did that, and then I broke the world record. But it was literally the most intense time, because I'm one of these people who needs to know all of the details.
Yeah.
So I would say, so how did that happen, and why did that happen? And if I wanted to do that, what would I need to do to get there? And it was sort of very in-depth questions, and it was never, you know, a one-word answer. So he massively helped me in that first... Well, he still does, but in terms of fast-tracking me into the sport, it was literally, you know, the fastest degree in cycling you could possibly have ever wanted to get.
That's phenomenal. And did the sort of swap to cycling, did you miss swimming? Was it hard to make the decision to move across?
I think it was hard for the people I was leaving behind, and I involved my swimming coach, Colin Hood, in the decision right from the start, because as soon as it was an option, I asked him what he thought I should do. And I, first of all, I said, well, I think I might wait until after the Games in Beijing. And he's like, yeah, but if you've got an extra 3 years under your belt before the London Games, and here we are outside the Velodrome.
Yes, London 2012.
I know. He said, if you've got this extra 3 years, that could be hugely advantageous. He said, if you my daughter, I'd tell you to move now. So he was really supportive and very pragmatic about the pros and cons. We had a really long chat about it. But I think for me, the thing that was similar was that at that point, I had an appointment every day with the Velodrome for training, which was very similar to swim training. You know, every day you'd have an appointment with a swimming pool.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the change, I wasn't getting wet every day, but I still had a similar schedule. It probably wasn't until after Beijing when I started to do more road training that it became a lot more different to swimming, but of course by then I was 3-4 years away from having been a swimmer.
And then straight after London you gave birth to your daughter, and then a year after Rio you gave birth to your son. How did life change on tour, becoming a mum and juggling that new routine?
Well, there was an element of timing required, so I think we set ourselves, certainly after London, a bit of a deadline, because it was going into the unknown. You know, there wasn't, it sort of at that point, I had no contemporaries who were mums, certainly not in the UK. It had been a good number of years.
It's definitely unknown territory, and still, I think, something that is relatively unknown. There aren't many sports women that have managed to have a child or two and come back and still perform at the highest level. Obviously, Helen Glover. Big shout out to Helen Glover.
Yes. No, I think for me, I'd obviously, early in my career, I'd been witness to Liz McColgan, and then Tani had had Karis after the Games in Sydney. And then if we go left here,
I like this.
The park.
We're getting a proper guided tour.
And then, yeah, after, so Tani obviously had Karis, Denise Lewis had had children along the way in her career, and Sally Gunnell perhaps towards the end of her career. So there had been women within my sporting lifetime, but there was a sort of a fairly big gap for me. I don't think there was sort of a role model after Tani, and although, you know, Tani's always remained a huge role model for me. I was probably the first of the current crop to have a baby. So we tried to make sure that we had a deadline with Louisa. If I wasn't pregnant by a certain point, we knew I wouldn't be able to come back before the World Championships in 2014. So we kind of had that, but fortunately we fell pregnant straight away, and Louisa arrived in the summer of 2013, and I was back on the track in 9 months later, going quicker than I had done in London.
That is unreal.
It was crazy.
Do you think there's some sort of element of mum power?
Possibly. I think sometimes. I mean, Nairi Kindred had had Ella, her baby, 13 months before the Games in London, and she always maintained that she'd never felt that endurance kind of spike. Now, this playground is one that many a happy time with Louisa and Charlie, during the hour record attempt. Louisa would have been out here playing.
And
but
you
it's
were
fantastic.
In there.
I was in there training. Spot this. This is why the park is so brilliant, to be able to come back and share it with them and show them where...
It's actually really nice to come with someone that's made memories and has experiences here, because I've been quite a few times. I didn't actually attend the Games. I was in New Zealand training at the time for my first Olympic. But I just remember watching it and being so inspired and thinking, I want a slice of that cake.
Yeah.
So it's nice to come here with someone where it actually really does mean something. It's cool.
Yeah, no, it's
wild to think you were here and you made history in that very park.
Put 2 gold medals in that velodrome, and then I came back after the road race with 4 gold medals under my pillow. It's just bonkers to think that. But I think after those Games, I didn't have any kind of expectation that I could ever be as good again. It was I'd done everything I'd ever wanted and more. Yeah. So having Louisa was, you know, the next big thing for us, and if I came back it was a huge bonus. And similarly, when Charlie arrived, you know, for me coming back after Charlie was a bit harder. He was a bigger baby, I was stretched a bit more. It took me a lot longer. I didn't get back to race weight probably until, you know, Tokyo almost, like as fully happy with the kind of body composition and like the balance of power to weight.
Is that very important in velodrome cycling, body composition?
Power to weight isn't as important in the velodrome as it is on the road.
Yeah.
And I kind of have been fast at all sorts of different body weights. But I think it was just as much about knowing I'd kind of got back to where I'd been previously, and that just gave me that confidence, I suppose. I've never really, since I had an eating disorder as a teenager, I've been very, very cautious as to how much emphasis I've placed on, you know, actual body mass.
Right.
So it's more about body composition, and muscle weighs a huge amount, as you know. So you have to be very mindful.
My legs are still there, still keeping them.
Absolutely. And I gained a huge amount of muscle having Charlie because I was pushing this big bump up hills. So to
lose...
Were you
one of those mums in the pram? Oh, yes. Love
that. Well, I was still riding my bike when I was right the way through to, you know, labour starting, and we live on top of a hill, and I was still climbing the hill at 38 weeks pregnant and adapted my handlebar position to be able to ride. So I guess for me, I was very aware of why I had extra muscle mass, and so just coming back to race weight was a gradual process I was prepared to take time doing.
Did your body composition change drastically pre and post birth, and do you think that has an impact on your performance?
I think my body composition was obviously massively different post-birth because I was breastfeeding, so I had, you know, extra fat stores to make milk, and I'd given birth to a human, so my body had extra fat stores to just exist and produce the antibodies needed. And so it's a very, you're asking a huge amount of your body.
Yeah.
And I was very, very aware of just how much I was asking of my body. So I was made sure that I ate healthily and that I utilized a good diet to manipulate body composition and focused on having muscle mass for function. So I've never used a gym to push weights to gain muscle mass, but the strength work that I did on my bike, making sure that I was lean and mean rather than looking at the number on the scales. And I think that's probably the healthiest way to do it. And obviously no one has come back and done as I was trying to do after having two children. So it was also about kind of this voyage of a little bit of discovery and without any pressure though, because I'd already achieved everything I wanted, but I'm competitive. So I still wanted to do well.
Not so just
if we
done
go
it
down
once.
This way, we'll go past where Barney and I lived during the games. So I'll show you that.
Nice. Yeah, not just done it once, done it twice. And then we had the extra year to wait.
Yes.
Was the extra year for you between Tokyo a blessing in disguise, giving you that extra time with the kids? Or was it challenging as you are on the older end of the spectrum?
Yeah, no, I am on the older end, and I think it's good.
I mean, I wouldn't say that, but you did compete in the Olympic Games in 1992, so.
Yeah, games number 8 was a bit annoying.
I retired and I've done 2 games and I was 1 at your first one.
Wow.
No, that is mad.
You're making me feel old just saying it. But no, I think for me...
I wouldn't say old, I would say legendary would be the word. Embrace it.
Oh, I am very much. And I think, you know, having to wait for my 8th games wasn't the most convenient thing. But I do remember saying to one of the staff members who I was working with in the run-up to Tokyo, actually, an extra year just means that I'll be a year post-birth.
Yeah.
I'd done the games in Rio when Louisa was just turned 3. So I was going to be doing the games in Rio just before, the games in Tokyo, just before Charlie was 3. So the first day to the games was sooner, like was me coming back quicker than I'd had to come back for Rio. So I think in that sense that it was more of a uh-oh for the competition rather than for me, because an extra year of preparation. I was also quite aware of the fact that, you know, I'd had time out from riding my bike, racing my bike rather. I mean, I raced when I was 20 weeks pregnant with Charlie.
20 weeks pregnant?
Just a local time trial, nothing
just
too hard.
Just a little one, nothing too hard.
But I'd raced. I was aware that I'd had time out when I was pregnant, so I knew what it was like to have a hiatus from racing. And so that mentality of having to wait and not knowing when the next race might be was something I felt comfortable with having experienced in it for a different reason.
Yeah.
So to that extent, it wasn't, you know, it was frustrating, but it wasn't something that I couldn't entertain as. Whereas some athletes, I felt so sorry for them, where they were like, I just can't imagine having to wait. I'm going to have to stop. And
no, because that can be such a long period of time.
Corner.
No way.
That was my apartment with Helen Scott and Aileen McGlynn. And Barney was on the other side. But when this was here, these two buildings weren't. So this was where our medical centre was.
Wow.
And then there was no building at all there. So we had a big kind of like area for coffee and stuff.
So that's where you lived during the Olympics?
So that's where I lived, during the games. And it was just amazing.
Oh, thanks for showing us.
It's so cool to come back. And I've been back to like these little eateries and stuff. And kind of just looked up and thought, wow. And it did feel like home. It was a really... You know, it's a really well put together games, and being a home games, you know, shipping in the extra furniture, because apartments are pretty sparse, aren't they? And so,
did you bring down stuff?
So the team, Paralympics GB, furnished the apartments and made them more homely and put some bright colour. I mean, they do that every Games, but
brought a little bit of zest.
Yeah, and that became really important in Tokyo, actually, because being a remote sport, we weren't in the main village. So cycling had two satellite villages, and village is a very loose term. It was more like a very poorly maintained holiday park with damp apartments and
not much natural light. That sounds delightful.
Yeah, so it wasn't the most inspiring place to live. Not compared to here, anyway.
So how have things changed for you since Tokyo 2020 and your quest to becoming the most decorated Team GB Paralympian? Has there been a greater interest in Paralympic sport?
Well, I think there is more people have watched what we've done, perhaps, because nobody could travel. So the TV coverage, seeking out sport on television as a bit of solace in the fact that we've had so many restrictions. But I think this has been one of the kind of frustrations of parasport. We have amazing coverage during the Games every 4 years. Yeah. But then the interim period for World Championships, European Champs, it just goes dead. And so we need to break that cycle. We need to stop this sort of cliff edge of coverage. Yeah. And make sure that we can tell that story of success, because not one of the World Championships I've raced at has been televised live. There might have been
crazy,
a live stream, but there has been a sort of
a bodge stream,
yeah,
maybe on some back-end YouTube-style website.
Yeah, and it's never really been fully kind of funded and pushed. And so you have this vicious cycle of not enough funding, not enough sponsorship to put on the coverage properly. So you do a bad job and no one watches it. So then that's proof nobody wants to watch it, so then no one does watch it.
What do you think it's going to take to break that stereotype?
I think it needs... So the Paralympic broadcaster to step up,
yep,
and commit to key events in between. So it might be this time we have the World Champs in Glasgow in 2023, which is all cycling disciplines at the same event. So that'll either be a really good thing, because all...
Is that for the first time ever?
That's the first time ever, yeah.
Well, that's big.
It's big, but it'll either be really good because everyone will get brilliant coverage,
yep,
or just
key
one
moments.
Or two disciplines will get great coverage and everyone else will be the also round. So that's going to be a really big test to see just how well that's done, and whether it's the UCI or the organisers that have to invest in making sure that the lesser well-known disciplines are also as well publicised. Because, you know, the British public, as we saw here at this velodrome and at Brands Hatch, they absolutely love having events on home soil, and they will, you know, cover that. They will come and watch and support.
Yep.
So it's not a lack of appetite. It's just kind of getting all of the numbers in the right place so that it looks good on a balance sheet at the end, and say, yeah, we need to keep investing in the coverage because look, this is helping the sport grow in this way.
And I think profiling and showcasing the Paralympics also 100% inspires the next generation of para athletes. You've been a huge role model in that movement. Do you have youngsters reaching out to you?
Yeah, and I think it's not just inspiring para-athletes. Of course, it's that huge thing, if you can't see it, you can't be it. So anyone who has sort of a mild impairment, as I have, thinks that, you know, there's nothing out there for them. They're not quite good enough in able-bodied sport. They're not quite as balanced. They're not quite as functionally able.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, you know, what is there for me? If they don't see someone like me and think, well, actually, that's me. I could be like that. But also mums and just... women in general, seeing like sporty girls, and we still have this challenge in that girls drop out of sport at a much bigger rate than boys.
Yeah.
And so trying to make sure that we retain girls in sport, it's as cool as anything. You can be a girly girl, but you can also get super muddy and sweaty and then go on and be a girly girl again. Or you can just be, you know, a super muddy, sweaty girl all the time if you want. Doesn't really matter.
Whatever your vibe is.
Sport is cool,
yeah,
for boys and girls, and everyone's welcome, and that's really important. So it's a huge privilege to be referred to as a role model and to have helped to inspire people, but I think we still have a huge amount of work to do to make sure that
definitely
that doesn't drop off in the years between each Games.
Right, now let's talk about your spotty nomination. So exciting.
It is.
To be a part of that eclectic group of awesome humans. I mean, what a way to mark the end of the year. You've also been nominated twice before. What's it going to take to take the win?
Oh, I don't know. It's, I mean, just to be on the shortlist is huge, really. When you think about, I mean, obviously we've been dying to get sport back after the lockdowns of 2020, and I was really fortunate to race at the very beginning of 2020. But yeah, I think to be on a shortlist like this in Olympic and Paralympic year, when you have had so much British success, and not just in Olympic and Paralympic sport as well. So I'm really excited, and I think I finished dead last in 2012. And
right, well, we've got to change that.
Second last in 2016.
Can we vote?
I hope so.
How do we vote?
So I think on the night you get told how to vote, but there's a BBC website. You can vote via there, and you can also vote through the phone-in. So you just need to set up as many different accounts for all your different emails, then okay. You'll get extra votes.
I think I have about 5 emails.
Yeah, so, 5 accounts,
okay,
5
you
votes.
Didn't hear that here, but what we're telling you, for anyone tuning in right now, make sure you vote for Dame Sarah Story on the BBC website. The winner is announced on Sunday the 19th of December, so make sure you tune in. You're going to be front row, of course.
I hope so. It's so going to be 8 o'clock start, and then they'll give you like 40 minutes during the show or something like that.
So it's a very quick window.
It's a very quick window.
Woo! Okay, so you've got
speed
to be,
dial.
You've got to be hot to trot, haven't you?
Yeah.
Phone burning in each hand, 2 phones.
Yep.
So what do you think winning an award like this would do for para sport?
Well, of course, Spotty's never been won by a para-athlete. Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson was 3rd, I think it was 2004. So to have a para-athlete, you know, win one of the top 3 trophies is just huge. But to actually win overall, it would just be huge. It would. I mean, it's never been done. It's hard to explain what it would do because it's never been done. But to showcase just how important para-sport is to everybody, to... you know how important my journey has been and to people as well, because you know people get to see the highs, they haven't all seen the lows and the hurdles,
and let's talk about some of the lows, because we've sort of skipped over that. There's been a lot of highs, and you are just fresh back off a new high.
Yeah,
but let's talk about some of the lows. Bullying, you mentioned an eating disorder. Tell me a little bit about the bullying that you received as a youngster at school.
Well, I think it was me coming back from the games as a, you know, going into year 10, and I'd done something pretty extraordinary for my age, and suddenly I was, you know, getting invites to national awards ceremonies that was pretty unusual, and I was arriving at school from morning training with wet hair, and I was never available at weekends, so I was just different, and difference often gets singled out and, you know, called and bullied, and I was just in that bracket. But I think I just wanted to be an athlete more than I wanted anything else, and so I just trundled on, if you like, and eating, controlling my eating and what I was eating was one of my ways to feel like I had control of the situation, even though that didn't really make any sense or doesn't make any sense to look back on.
Yeah.
At the time, it was the one thing that I could maintaining, and I also just didn't feel like eating a lot of the time during the school day, because if I was eating, I'd have to go into communal spaces, and I just didn't want to be
so
anywhere.
So the eating thing, it was more to do with being around everybody else and not wanting to be around everyone else because you didn't feel welcome.
Yeah, just wanting to make sure that I had control of the location I was in, and I used to either go out running at lunchtime with the cross-country team, or I'd go for a walk by myself to just get away and have control of the location. Because, of course, in the classroom, you know, there's only so much that can happen. If I got caught in a cubicle of the toilets, I'd have to listen to the, you know, the girls talking about me, oh, who does she think she is, and just you wait until I get hold of her and all this kind of thing, and you just think, well, what have I done? What are you going to do when you get hold of me? And you sort of hopefully never wait around to find out. But it's just psychological kind of torment, really.
Yeah.
Making you feel unwelcome, moving chairs so that there was nowhere to sit other than next to the boys, and then kind of calling you out for always sitting with the boys when you actually have no control over that now. And just, it's really petty stuff. But at the time, that psychological kind of torture, is it what it felt like, was, you know, just you're the walking conversation stopper and you're not really sure why.
That is utterly terrifying, and nobody should have to ever go through that experience at school. How did you overcome that and continue to push forward in your career
I think because I really enjoyed what I was doing at the weekends, so those 2 days at the weekends with my swim teammates and a lot of those people I'm still in touch with, and you know, we've exchanged messages over the last few months since the games and tried to meet up with people and things. I think having, you know, those people to spend the weekends with, although it was only 2 days out of the five, they were far bigger, so I would live for the weekends. And I was fairly fortunate, I suppose. I never did a full week at school. I always had to leave early or had to go somewhere at least one day. So I think my attendance averaged for my final 2 years at 4 days a week. So I was maximising my opportunities not to be around school. And, you know, it's very difficult to pinpoint. There's no evidence, but everyone just knew that I wasn't very popular. And I think if I'd have been a really big-headed individual and always been kind of swanning around with medals or something, but I just kept my head down, and in hindsight maybe that made it worse, because they thought, actually, you know, she thinks she's better than us, she never talks about what she does at the weekend, she's never available at the weekends, we don't like this person because she's different to us, and we're just going to make her existence near us as unpleasant as we can.
Do you have any advice for those right now at school for dealing with bullying, having lived that journey, looking back?
I think it's sharing the turmoil that you're going through with someone trusted who will listen. They may not have advice they can offer at that point. There may not be anything that can be done right at that second, but it's sharing. A problem shared is a problem halved. Knowing that you're not alone in that journey and trying to kind of focus on the good aspects. So I did have friends at school, and most of them were a couple of years above me. So once they realised what was going on, then they kind of took me under their wing as best they could and kind of made sure that I always had someone to go and talk to, or they'd kind of beckon me over if they looked like there was an awkward situation going on. And I'll always be forever grateful that they were around, but of course they weren't always there unless they were in sixth form. The last 2 years, some of them weren't around. So I think it's just finding those allies that you do have. And school doesn't last forever, and it's not easy, and it shouldn't happen. And obviously schools will do the best they can to try and stop it, but sometimes when there's no evidence, it's really, really hard.
I love that theory. A problem shared is a problem halved. That's for sure a takeaway.
Yeah, I think, and also for me, because you've told somebody, it means it's not eating away at you. And if you can always go to that person, just say how you're feeling, then, and that for me, you know, my teachers knew that something was happening, but they never caught those people in the act. Whether it's easier or harder in a digital age, I'm not sure, because you can perhaps see comments, but you can be anonymous with those comments. You can make up an avatar name or whatever. Exactly. So I don't think it's necessarily any easier or harder than it was, because people could still be relatively anonymous.
Well, you're almost more accessible, actually, really interestingly. On the last podcast, if you did tune in, we spoke with Becky Addington about trolling.
Yes.
And for her, it was all about blocking, deleting, removing.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just an invasion of your personal space on a constant basis.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there was no way I could block and delete people who were there sort of in your ear, because they were real, and they were moving chairs in classrooms and deliberately trying to block your way in corridors, and just standing back then if they thought someone might have seen them. So It is a completely different thing. And I think, you know, cyberbullying is just, it creates the same turmoil, and bullies will always exist. And often bullies are after have a cry for help themselves. And it's always hard to look at those people and feel sorry for them when you're, you know, hurting inside as well.
I bet you those bullies would want to be friends with you now.
Who knows? I can't say I've seen them.
Have you got your dress ready for next Sunday?
Oh my goodness, this is like the most traumatic thing in the world, isn't it? Trying to decide what to wear.
Have you got something lined up?
Well, I have a backup plan.
Yeah.
If I don't get offered something from, you know, like Jenny Packham Gucci or, you know.
Oh, casual.
Hey, yeah, somebody can borrow it. Let me borrow it.
That's the level we're on here. Rolling with the dame, aren't we?
If only, you know, that's the pipe dream. Yeah, I have a dress in my wardrobe that I haven't worn for about 4 years, so I think I might wear that.
Nice. Well, you know, reusing is cool these days.
It is, absolutely. And it's
you know what? I'll let you into a secret. I went to two events 2 weeks ago, and on the Tuesday, I wore one dress, didn't take any pictures. Then I went out on the Thursday, wore it again at the Team GB ball.
Amazing.
Yes, you heard it here. But I think I might need to pop into Westfield myself after this and get something for next weekend.
But I may have worn the dress I'm thinking I might wear. I wore a different colour version just after Tokyo. I was one of these people who I liked the dress so much I bought it in every colour available.
Yeah, every colour.
I've done that with shoes as well.
I may have done that with these.
Yes, it's always a good thing. I bought the white version of these trainers as well.
I feel like we're similar on the multiplying.
Comfy. Yeah, if it's comfy, it's going to work.
I can walk in it, I'll have a few pairs. Brilliant. What's your relationship like with the start of the week? Appreciate things probably vary very much so.
Yeah, so Monday morning, it's get the kids to school day, first day of the week. To be fair, they both love their school, so it's always a fairly good day. And also, I don't think that as athletes, we've ever really had a proper weekend. So it's not like you're suddenly starting work on a Monday.
Like, weekends don't really exist when you're an athlete.
So for me, Monday morning could just as well be a Friday morning, because if I've had a rest day on a Thursday, I've never had a rest day on a Sunday, and I've usually raced in the season. So for me, Mondays are no different to any other day, and I embrace every day, because each day is another opportunity.
Too right. Glasgow, 2023, you mentioned the inclusion of para within all the other disciplines. That's really exciting. You've been competing in the Olympics since 92. Are we going to see you competing at that event in 2023?
I really, really hope so. I've been really fortunate in my career as a cyclist that I competed in the Glasgow Commonwealth Games in the individual pursuit. And there was no para-athlete events for me there. I competed in the team pursuit. So in Glasgow in 2023, there's an opportunity to try and qualify for two different disciplines. A para-discipline and a non-para-discipline.
Go on.
So we'll have to see when the schedule comes out. But to have an event, I mean, this is going to be a thing every 4 years now. The year before every Olympic and Paralympic Games, there will be a big World Championships for all cycling disciplines. And so para-cycling, both track and road, will be included alongside all the other cycling disciplines. And there's actually more than you realise. So there's mountain bike, cross-country, downhill, BMX, freestyle, and
Supercross,
absolutely. And there's obviously track and road with the time trial. And then there's artistic cycling and dance cycling as well.
Dance cycling?
Yeah, I can't
That's
remember the exact
new
name.
One to me.
There's so many disciplines that you don't realise.
Are you going to take up that?
No.
learn a new skill casually in 2 years.
I'm not very good at wheeling. Maybe there'll be some others who could wheelie out. You have to kind of, I don't know. I'm not very good at dancing.
Me neither.
So, yeah, so I think it's going to be really fascinating. It's going to be a huge, probably around a month, a celebration of cycling. And it gives, I mean, Glasgow's doing some fantastic work on building more cycling infrastructure and active travel lanes. And so it really all kind of showcases this whole breadth of cycling, from a mode of transport, something that's great for fun and leisure, and then also obviously right the way up to the pinnacle of the podium. And so Scotland's going to be really, you know, bringing all of those messages out with this one big massive event.
Unreal. Well, my fingers and toes are crossed for you for that. That really would be a feat to compete. Can I ask how old you'd be?
So,
Or is that really rude?
So in 2023, I'll be 45 at Glasgow. I'll be 45, nearly 46. And then Paris, I'll be 46, nearly 47.
Unbelievable. So all eyes are set on Glasgow and then Paris. Love that. You heard it here. Dame Sarah Story. There is absolutely no stopping this woman. A massive good luck for next week. We will all be watching, and everybody tuning into the podcast, make sure to vote. Monday Mile listeners, that is a wrap. Thank you so much for tuning in to our Walk and Talk podcast. You know what to do. The audio drops at 2 a.m. every single Monday, and the visual highlight will be on Instagram at Amy_Fuller. Go and support our girl, Dame Sarah Story. A massive good luck, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.